Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Was born in Vietnam in 1977 and arrived in Australia with his family as a refugee in 1979. He'll tell us a bit about the rest of his story tonight. But he won the Varuna Award for Manuscript Development in 2004, which led to the publication of Where the Sea Takes Us, a Vietnamese-Australian story, which has just come out, and that's why he's here tonight. And Janet Grundy from Next Chapter Books has got some copies outside. But Dr. Hun lectures in refugee politics and political deception at the Australian National University in Canberra, where lots of deception goes on. Tonight he's going to talk for us on the topic
Journey to Modernity.
Mum, Dad and International Relations, that's what it is. Reinvigorating politics with everyday life and vice versa. Kim, you're welcome. Thank you.
I'm very honoured indeed and in truth a little overwhelmed to be at the Sydney Institute. And I was also going to say how grateful I am to Jared for inviting me here to come and speak. However, gratitude isn't quite the right word. Largely because Jared owes me, he owes me big time. let me explain why. Jared mentioned it already, but last year he kindly accepted an invitation from me to make a keynote speech at a conference that I had organised marking a decade of John Howard's Prime Ministership. And I was chuffed by this acceptance, particularly because, as he revealed to me that evening, this was the first academic engagement that he had made for some 30 years. Now, I won't go into the nitty-gritty details of his speech, but I can best describe it and that speech to a room full of Australia's top political scientists, many of them my mentors, as something akin to a blast of cobra venom or a can of mace sprayed directly into the face of the nation's chattering classes. And in the ferocious question and answer session that followed, Jared took time out to assert that if anyone was to blame for him being there and for him ruffling so many feathers, then it was surely me. A hapless and eager young academic. So that's why I'm very honoured and happy to speak at the Sydney Institute tonight, but gratitude is not quite the right word. And I am, of course, here to discuss my book, Where the Sea Takes Us. And I'll be very careful not to go over the time allocated, because I understand there's a spectacular lunar eclipse on this evening, and I would hate to keep anyone away from their celestial observations. So let me first and very briefly tell you what I think the book is about before exploring, in a slightly strange and challenging sort of way, what I think the whole thing means. Where the Sea Takes Us, as far as I'm concerned, can be understood at three levels. It's foremost a book about people, my parents, and all the events from their infancy right up to their adulthood that culminated with their decision to leave their homeland, Vietnam. Now, it's also a book about a country, and I try my best to capture not only the history of war and colonisation that we more commonly associate with Vietnam, but also the culture and literature that constitute the heart and soul of the nation. And finally, Where the Sea Takes Us is about ideas. Particularly, it's about the ideologies that had such a profound impact on Vietnam and the world during the Cold War. I'm talking about Marxism, Leninism, Maoism, and liberal democracy. And through an explanation of how these ideologies were articulated and advanced in my parents' ordinary lives, the book taps into a momentous tension between tradition and modernity in 20th century Vietnam. Now, over the past few weeks, I've been fortunate enough to speak to a few audiences about my book. And generally, people want to know a little bit about the people, a very, very little bit about the ideas, and quite a lot about Vietnam. In fact, I've sensed a great craving in some people for the Oriental that I can only partially satisfy. It's as if many of these people expect me to come in rowing a sampan, wearing a conical hat, or riding side saddle on the back of a water buffalo, playing a bamboo flute. Now, these preconceptions, they don't really bother me, at least not very much. There's no doubt that the book's about the exotic Far East and about Orientals. But it's also about broader issues that I think are pertinent to all of us. And so I want to take the opportunity tonight to rectify the balance somewhat and engage with a more sophisticated audience, you good people, about some of the important ideas behind the book. And in particular, I'm going to explore the practical and philosophical relationship between everyday life and politics, between the experiences of my ordinary parents and some of the most extraordinary events in modern human history. My efforts to try and negotiate this relationship between mum, dad and international relations is basically what makes Where the Sea Takes Us stand apart from other biographies. It's basically what makes it different and hopefully a little special. Okay, to this end, I want to read out a short section of the book and then reflect upon what the personal experiences in this extract have to say about some of the great political and philosophical developments of our time. And the section comes from chapter 5, which is entitled, Modernity Made My Father and My Aunt Affluent Without Enriching Them. And each of the chapter titles refer to a major political idea that is subsequently explored in the contents of that chapter through the prism of my parents' lives. For example, modernity, colonialism, totalitarianism, nationalism, etc. And I preface this chapter with a contemporary conversation between me and my parents in which I try to illustrate some of the methodological difficulties of researching one's loved ones, what I regard as the perils of navigating that space between the personal and the political. And this chapter 5 conversation takes place in the study of my family home with my father and I gathered around the computer. And it sounds mundane to start with, but I encourage you to bear with me because it's an exchange that many of you, I hope, will be able to relate to, perhaps from his perspective. So start up with me. Okay, let's go through this again, Dad, I say. There are two steps. First, we have to dial up the internet service provider, the ISP. And when we've done that, you'll see those two little flashing boxes in the corner. That means we're connected. Then we use what's called a browser, a program on our computer that allows us to surf the net. Sometimes things go wrong. It's not perfect. For one reason or another, the internet site that we want to visit might be down or our ISP might not be responding. Nothing's exact or assured when it comes to the internet. Do you understand? Do you want me to go over it again? Obviously, I went too quickly last time. I understand, Dad said. Don't raise your voice and treat me like a child. I've taught you to ride a bike, do algebra and drive a car, remember? Parents care for their children with a patience as boundless as the sky and sea. Children care for their parents while counting the months and days. Do you remember that saying, Dad? Probably not. It doesn't matter. Where's the internet right now? Where's my email? The two little boxes are there in the corner, but I don't see anything on the screen. And I reply, that's because you just minimised the window. We have to go over this again. Here, give me the mouse, I said. The internet window is currently minimised. You'll remember that this does not mean that the program is closed. You don't have to open it again. It's just down here out of the way. If we click on it, then it maximises. And that means it fills the whole screen. There's another choice. This button here we call Restore allows us to adjust the size of the window so I can make it as wide or as long as I like by clicking and dragging the edges. Okay, Dad said, all I want to do is restore the window or whatever and call it and check my email. What do you mean, I asked? Do you want me to maximise it? No, I want to restore it, he says. Where's the button that you just showed me? I said, shit, Dad. It's already restored. restore, then the restore button becomes the maximize button. When it's maximized, the maximize button becomes the restore button. How many times do we have to go over it? And Dad responds finally, don't yell at me. You don't like to help out your father, that's fine. You will not yell at me. My friend's son taught him how to use the internet, send emails, type in Vietnamese, and even organize his holidays over the internet. Do you think he ever yelled at his father? You can leave now, the dad says. I'll figure it out myself. I've done far more difficult things in my time. I just have to work at it for a bit longer. I just have to strike a little bit of luck. So from this short extract, you can see that Where the Sea Takes Us is no Mao's Last Dancer or Wild Swans. Both marvellous books in different ways. It's not a Confucian homage from a child to his parents. It's very much about intergenerational conflict and personal angst. And in this instance, the tension grows out of an insolent son's frustration with the knowledge that his father is getting old, that his invincible old man is no longer invincible and perhaps even a little frail. But what does this very personal exchange and a subsequent chapter have to say about politics and international relations? I'm going to propose that the Microsoft source squabble between me and my father symbolises a greater tension between tradition and modernity, and it also offers an insight into the limits of technology and proposes a near infallible formula for success in life. Okay, so firstly, how do these momentous epochs of tradition and modernity, how are they represented in my book? I have to point out the element of irony in this extract, in which my father is struggling to come to grips with technological advancements. And it's ironic because the rest of the chapter is about his conquering of all things electrical. It's the story of how, through curiosity and endeavour, my father pulled himself out of his village and a predestined life as a peasant to become an electrical technician, a champion of light against darkness. And it's about how he challenged the superstitious and deeply old-fashioned ways of his ancestors, and particularly that of my grandmother, and how he dared to understand and harness the powers that Westerners had brought to Vietnam to use, by and large, against the natives. So to understand this part of my father's life is to understand a little bit more about the ethos of the Enlightenment and the avant-garde movement that swept the globe during the 1960s and the history of Vietnamese modernity itself. And these liberal forward-looking values also help explain my father's decision in 1978 to leave Vietnam. It was a decision that my conservative grandmother was initially opposed to. My grandmother could see no sense in us risking everything on a rickety boat and potentially destroying the family line, which only passed through males as far as she could see. Our life is not as good as it was before, she said, but it has been worse, as she pointed out to my dad at the time. Things aren't bad. We have a house to live in and enough rice to eat, and if things take a turn for the worse, then we can survive on rice soup alone. But if you were to leave and never come back, the spirits of our ancestors would suffer no end. Now, my dad understood my grandmother's position, but was forever frustrated with her. In his view, she was still living in the jungle, running away from the French and the Viet Minh, and preoccupied with the ghosts of the past. The perseverance, it seemed to Dad, was the only option for his mother and so many other Vietnamese of her traditional generation. And in his view, they were backward-looking peasants who, as Confucius said, were like reeds in a stream that had no choice but to bend with the current. He, my dad, on the other hand, as a beacon of modernity, could not lie down and accept his fate. And that's pretty much why I'm here today. So through Dad's encounter with Windows XP, I know that Microsoft is a sponsor of the Sydney Institute, but let me say that I'm sure Vista is much more easier to use. So through this encounter, I try to convey a message about his and Vietnam's encounter with the forces of modernity. And by and large, modernity was a wonderful thing, maybe like XP, for my father and his country. It brought new ideas, technologies, and opportunities. However, through this computer story, I also try to allude to the limits and crisis points that are inherent in the modernisation process. And this is elaborated in that chapter 5 when my father gets his dream job. He becomes an electrical technician at the tender age of 26. He's sent back to his home province and placed in charge of the regional electricity authority. And to make a long story short, Dad became intoxicated with power in many different ways. For the first time in his life, he was in charge of people, and many of whom were much older than him, but who could barely fathom his technological know-how. He was also admired by many country folk for extending the electrical grid in south central Vietnam at that time, and for bringing power to the countryside, for granting the villagers and peasants light. But my father's hubristic bubble was punctured in 1968 when his older brother, my uncle, was killed fighting for the South Vietnamese Army. And he was once again reminded, my father that is, of the sorrow of war. And he then realised, at least for the time being, that life doesn't always head forward and upwards, that sometimes it can crash terribly in a heap or evolve in perplexing cycles. And he realised that technological knowledge and power are not substitutes for wisdom and care. So alongside the story of my dad's rise and fall in that chapter, I try to come to grips with America's intervention in and defeat in Vietnam. And I look at pivotal individuals like Robert McNamara and General William Westmoreland, who, like my dad, had a blind sort of faith in technological might and statistical data as substitutes for human intelligence, prudent nation building, and what the communists called a genuine, a just cause. Now that I continue to treat my old man with such terse disrespect every time that we turn on the computer, still today I should say, shamefully, it also suggests to me how prone all of us are to not paying attention to the glaring lessons of history. And to this extent, I could understand why we're in Iraq and why we're losing. Now, if we're trying to unravel some of the events in my dad's life, let me now address some of his ideas, and particularly how his everyday ethics have contributed to my understanding of philosophy, both in my career as an academic egghead and in my personal undertakings. And by doing this, all I'm trying to say is that our everyday thoughts really aren't all that mundane, and that the most esoteric philosophies are in fact accessible and useful to us as ordinary people. So I want to briefly describe and go over my father's formula for success, which he mentions in that extract. To be successful in life, he says, you need three things: hard work, talent, and a little bit of luck. Now, when I was a teenager, I was utterly fed up with this dictum. I thought it's simplistic nonsense that came out of my father's mouth ad nauseum. But after years of studying philosophy, strangely enough, I've returned to it. Indeed, I haven't come up with a more sound and complete theory for living the good life. Allow me to explain why. Dad's philosophy, I think, goes a long way to reconciling the nature-nurture debate that's at the core of all sociological questions, and which intellectuals like Richard Dawkins explicate in far less eloquent ways through things called memes, which we can talk about later. He also draws upon the empowering ideas of the great French Enlightenment philosopher Voltaire, whose work Dad studied at high school. And Voltaire asserted that we are all equally the toys of destiny, but this does not mean that we should descend to fatalism or indifference. For some of us are destined to reason well, said Voltaire, while others are destined to reason badly. Some of us are predisposed to what he called much merit and great talent, and we shall never know if we do not live our lives proactively and to the fullest potential. Now, my father's formula for success builds upon this Voltairean tradition. Simply stated, according to my old man, human agency, what he calls hard work, counts for a lot in our lives, as the God-given gene, talent. Now, the balance between the two is for us to decide. However, even when we put these together, our talent and hard work is not enough to guarantee success. There's also that element of luck, says my dad, the acknowledgement of which provides some solace in times of abject failure, something to also know about. Now I want to now extend my discussion to the utility and eloquence about the utility and eloquence of everyday philosophy by introducing some of the wisdom and imagery that I've garnered from researching and listening to my mum. Now, as I've mentioned, Dad is an exemplary modernist and has a penchant for formulae. From Mum, on the other hand, I've learned the value of modesty and the more subtle beauty of metaphor. Now, a few years ago, we used to walk to a pond every morning where my mother would feed an adopted flock of ducks. And this was also the time that I interviewed her and that she taught me Vietnamese. And one morning, when I asked her why she had such an affection for these birds, she raised an instructive finger and said to me, "When ducks paddle around in their ponds, they reveal a blissful calm that belies their frantic and tireless work beneath the surface. They are not graceful like swans, which I also like, or as dashing as eagles, and they have failed to evolve specialised traits like wide, spoon-shaped bills or extra-long legs that might give them an advantage over other birds. Nonetheless, their coats are resistant to the heaviest downpour. Ducks can float on the water, swim in the sea, walk on the land, and fly in the sky. They are incapable of doing any one thing very well, but are able to manage just about everything, and that's why they flourish." Now this is a marvellous metaphor, I think, for the virtue of modest everyday living. And it reminds me of the political imagery and rhetoric that great duckish figures like Ho Chi Minh, Gandhi, and dare I say John Howard, skillfully adopted to enamour themselves to the masses. And to continue the bird thing, in a letter to Vietnam that I use as a postscript to Where the Sea Takes Us, my mother makes one of the most incisive and vivid arguments for a rich Australian multicultural life that I've ever come across. After describing how we have been helped by so many kind Australians in settling here as refugees, but also how we have been abused and mistreated by a few, Mum wrote in a letter to a niece who she'd left behind in Vietnam, she wrote, "The bad things in Australia are no match for all that is good about it. Most Australians are generous and carefree. Sometimes they remind me of Canberra's colourful birds, which fly around in loving pairs or mighty flocks. Springtime here is so much prettier than any garden or forest that I have seen. But there are also a few black and white birds that swoop and screech at passers-by and think that everyone wants to steal their eggs." Now, as Jared mentioned, I taught a course on refugee politics earlier this year, and I could not help but associate with those who advocate the harshest and most inhumane forms of border security, the attributes of magpies. Some of these people have a black and white views of nationalism and identity, and don't fully realise the consequences of their misguided attempts to maintain our borders and to protect what is dear to them. Before concluding, I want to make a small but important caveat. By incorporating everyday life values and ideas in our politics, I'm not advancing some form of crass popularism or Hansonite revival. On the contrary, poll and focus-driven politics, Big Brother evictions, which none of you would know about, I'm sure, the elevation of the mediocre and mundane are all very much antithetical to what I'm on about tonight. Now, these political and cultural developments, as far as I can see, are mechanised, patronising, and utterly superficial. And they have a dehumanising impact on the people who they purport to champion. On the contrary, what I'm searching for is a more considered, rather than a more calculating form of politics. Forms of politics that are deeply moral and in which the ends don't always justify the means. Now, I want to finish off by expanding upon what my book might have to offer us today in modern 21st century Australia. It's useful first to ask what any biography has to offer us. And as far as I can see, a good biography does at least three things. It takes us to another place, it evokes the familiar, and whether through encouragement or caution, inspires us to be better. And while it's not a masterpiece, Where the Sea Takes Us, I can sort of confidently say, does all of these things. It takes us to Vietnam in a far more meaningful way than any travel book that I've read. because it gives us a sense of what it means to be Vietnamese. We learn about the stories, the songs, and the tragedies and triumphs of a nation. And most importantly, we learn about this exotic place through the eyes of people who we can relate to, my mum and dad. And we see how they deal with the same sort of physical and metaphysical trials that we have to confront on a daily basis. How are we going to keep our loved ones happy and healthy? How do we cope with the rejection and loss? How can we gain a little more change in our pockets and a little more pride in our hearts? And what's the meaning of life? And is there a God at the end of it who we can know? Now, since the book's publication, several people have strangely enough said to me how amazing they think my parents are. And at all times, I've maintained that they are, in fact, very ordinary, and probably you wouldn't want to meet them. That if it weren't for my book, you'd see my dad behind the counter of our bakery and think that's just another Vietnamese guy in another Vietnamese bakery. Or you might see mum at the pool and think she really needs to work on her backstroke. And I maintain this position because mum and dad remind us that we don't have to be extraordinary to totally commit ourselves to the values that we hold dear and to sacrifice everything for the people that we love. It's very much my parents' ordinariness that makes them inspirational for me. Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.